Identification, tape two, side A of the interview with Harry Rosenberg.
So, as I said, the work required a lot more detailed work, and it became a little bit different, and a lot of very fine enzymology had to be done, and took patience and things, and there were more students around the place, but somehow he became more interested in the school as a whole. He sort of became a matter of politics, I think, and there were all sorts of things going on around the place that took more and more of his time. And there was a fellow called Bill Goddard, who was the business manager of the school, and he would have him and Jack White, who was the technical manager, in at certain times. And I said to Enrico, you know, we've got to somehow set up a system where I have access to you and you have to be in the lab, you know. Oh yes, I mean, he was all for it. And he said, well, these are the times that Goddard can come and see me, and all the other times I'm in the lab. Well, it didn't work. I mean, sometimes Goddard would come in with some emergency. I don't know whether Enor didn't give him a free hand to sort of do a lot unsupervised or what, but he seemed to come with almost every problem he had it come to Enor. Maybe he didn't have the right to make decisions. That I don't know. But more and more often, he was either there, or he would be at some meetings, or he would be out to some other places. I don't really know. He had a very large circle of very close personal friends amongst the ambassadorial lot. And, you know, I mean, if you only go to the National Day of half of them, you're going to a National Day every second week from 11:30 till 1:30 or whatever it is. I've just been to one of the Germans, I think that's what it is. And, you know, he had these commitments with all sorts of other things, both social and others. And he came to the lab less and less. And eventually I realized that it was no longer in his RAM all the time. You know, I mean, like in a computer, you can either have it on the hard disk or you can have it on the RAM. If it's on the hard disk, it doesn't bother your nerve cells. You've got to have it in your RAM all the time. So every time that you are free, it churns around and you're thinking about it, even if you don't know about it, and suddenly you stop dead in your tracks and say, yes, you know, that is something I have to try. And if you don't do that, then you're out of the game. And that's what must have happened. And I don't say this in a negative way, because it must have been, to a great degree, a sort of definite personal conscious choice with him. But he very much regretted it. And he always wanted to be in it. And it got to the point where his presence in the lab was diminished considerably. Now. And eventually it became very small. But he still kept his finger on things. And then even that became less and less. And I would say to him, all right, I want that segment every so often of time, free of everybody else, so we can talk about it and I can brief you. And he said, right, Harry, you're first on the agenda, right? And then I'd come and he wouldn't be there sometimes, or he'd have Goddard with him, you know. And he said, oh, look, can we make it 4 o'clock this afternoon? Okay. And eventually I thought that the briefings were no longer getting there, because he had so many other things on his mind. It's somehow didn't go. But when it went there, he still connected very brilliantly, you know, and he was there. But it was continuously diminishing because his interests were going elsewhere. I think he was already then planning probably other things. I don't know what it was. And so eventually things, you know, got to the stage when I didn't really think that there is any future in it. You know, switch off.
Can you recall anything of the relationship between Enel and Flory?
That is one area where I am really not very well acquainted with. I know only the odd rumors which I heard from other people. Bede Morris, George Mackinnis, I don't know who would know best. But Flory still considered going to Canberra. I understand that there was resistance from here, that he wasn't really wanted altogether. But whether that was Enor or Honan or somebody else, I think the whole administration was a bit concerned that when a heavyweight like Flory goes in, nothing will be done without his approval, you know, because he was a pretty strong character. And he came to Canberra several times for a couple of months, him with his other fellow, what's his name?
Gordon Sanders.
Yes, sir, Gordon Sanders. And they did a bit of research. And I remember one thing, because Flory used to sit there and examine things, and Sanders particularly, and they had this big black sort of lamp, you know, that was shining on their stuff with a big light. And years later, when Doherty moved into physiology and cleaned the place out, I came to work one morning and saw this lamp that Flory used standing on the landing, ready to be picked up by the garbage people, and it's there behind you now. I just had to put a new top on it. But so I really can't tell you all that much about this, but I know that Flory wrote and said, oh yes, I think Henry Harris told me that Flory insisted that if he comes, Henry Harris should come with him. And I think the people here said no. They won't take anybody in. But nowadays, you know, when they take in new professors, they bring in hordes of people with them. And that was one thing I think I recalled from Henry. And the other thing is, you see, when I was in Oxford, I suddenly got this call, and Flory said, you know, would you come to my place for tea or coffee and cake such and such an evening? On a, you know, it's like a royal command. Of course, I said yes. So I drove up there that evening and walked up to his place, and I was surprised to find the whole department of from the dance school, all the big guys, you know, Abrahams and Kit van Heiningen, everybody was there, Henry Harris and the others, all there with their wives. Well, some of the wives, I think. And we all very genially, you know, had coffee and cake. And then completely unexpectedly, Flory says to me, now, Harry, I want you to tell all these people what are the good reasons why they should come out of here and go to Canberra. Yeah, nearly died, you know. I said, heck, you know, who am I? I'm just sort of, I'm just a postdoc. I don't know much about the workings of the university. I said, what can I tell you? I said, I think you would get facilities that probably would be unmatched in England. I said, you have much better weather than you have in England, and sometimes that's useful. I said, you would could be very close to your work, which of course didn't apply, because in Oxford everything is just a bicycle ride away. And you know, it's a new place, you'll be able to start a new place from scratch and all this, but I said, I really couldn't tell you all that much more. And I should have said maybe a few other things, and then he thanked me. And that was that. But, of course, they didn't come. Now, I don't know, I can't sort of reconciliate those two things, and that is that I was told that he wanted to bring Henry Harrison, maybe somebody else, with him, and the university said no, and yet he asked me why to tell all those people why they should come to Canberra when there really wasn't a chance for them to come. Or maybe that was before he realized that the university didn't want him to bring a big team. And maybe they just didn't want to bring some people. Maybe Henry Harris was particularly unwanted, although, of course, recently he has been asked to take the directorship of this school, you know, some years ago, and he came out and looked, and he said no. And in fact, I'm just thinking maybe the vice chancellorship, but I'm not sure. Henry has been here on a couple of occasions, and I don't know what it was for. We saw him each time, dinner here once, and then we had dinner with him at Gibson's place. And I matched him up here at this table with Eugene Kamienka, with whom they both went to school. And even then, Henry managed to tell Eugene Kamienka that he beat him in a few things. And of course, if you've read Henry's biography, then you realize the kind of type he is. And how many firsts he got. Anyway, so I don't know what it was with Henry Harris, with that proposal, but it certainly was something to do with that. And
it might have been something to do with the term of the commitment that Florey was prepared to make too.
Well, that could be. Yeah, he probably wouldn't have stayed all the time. He ghosted dog again. So,
can we put a date on that? You were postdoc from when to when? We were trying to put a date on that meeting with Florey.
That's easy enough. That would have been towards the end of 1956, because we were in Oxford. Then I don't think it would have been the beginning of that year. It would be towards the end.
Yes, that sounds right.
I tend
to see Florey as the patron of the school. I mean, whether he was here or not, and the patron far beyond the direct association.
Definitely. I mean, he was terribly interested. I remember when he came to the I think it came, must have been the opening of the new school when he came, and he spoke, you know, saying what he expected of us and what he expected the school to be, and all that. He really was very concerned with it all the time. And, I mean, not only this, you know, I mean, it was expected of me that as soon as I arrived in Oxford that I would go and present myself to Florey. And I remember, because I knew him, because he's been here a number of times before that. And I remember coming in and, the first thing I found out was that when I went to Barclays Bank to open an account, and there was supposed to be a couple of £100 there, the money wasn't there. So when I went to Florey the same afternoon, he said to me, well, your first research project, Harry, is to find a house for your family. And then he says, you can get on with other things. And he says, well, how are things? And then he called the inner secretary. This is typical of Florey. You have tea cake and tea with him in the afternoon. And I said to him, you know, I arrived here penniless and there was supposed to be a draft of money in the bank, but it's not there. So he called in his secretary and he says, take a telegram to Enor. I remember every word. He says, Rosenberg arrived penniless. Take action, Florey. That was it. And next morning the money was in the bank.
And a letter followed up. Which said, I really must send you a rocket. This is Florey to Enor.
Is that right?
Yes.
I didn't know that. Of course, I never looked at any archives like that.
Trevor Williams mentions it, but it's I don't know in association with your name, but we've come across the letter and in the archives, and it's the sharpest exchange, I guess. between Florey and Inouye, just on that question. But it was symptomatic of Florey's impatience with anything that went wrong administratively. And I think he was extremely intolerant, showed little understanding of what was happening in Australia and what the difficulties were. I'm just trying to get to the bottom of that whole relationship that Florey had.
I didn't know that how that happened. But anyway, that's what happened. And the money was there the next day. Mind you, Barclays Bank still wouldn't open an account because I had to get references. £200 in hand wasn't good enough. Mm-hmm.
Going on to some of the other people, and I know we're going to run out of time, but we might need to resume at some stage if you don't mind. How was Inouye regarded by the rest of the troops, or not the troops, I should say, so much as the heads of departments?
Oh, the heads of departments, that's probably more difficult, because I think he had personal relationships with them on different levels. I mean, I know he was very friendly, say, with Colin Curtis. I don't know about Fenner. I think probably also with Frank Fenner. Albert was poison. Sandy Oxton, fine. Who else was there?
Well, Mekinis in the very early days.
George Mekinis, who was acting head of pathology. I'm not sure what happened there, but I mean, we have had dinners together. And I think originally it was quite friendly. What happened afterwards, I really don't know. You see, we were the lower troops, and we really were told think on the need-to-know basis and no more. And everything was very strict. I mean, the secretaries would never say a word about anything that happened. Nobody knew. What went on in the inner sanctum, nobody knew. I mean, don't forget that we didn't have a faculty until God knows how long.
Now, was there resistance to that notion of the school committee, which was made up solely of the heads of departments?
That's right. The school committee was very much Enor's way of handling things. And there was a school committee, and of course Goddard was always there with them. Although on occasions he wasn't. He was shoved out. And then I think they got some representatives from the department, non-professorials, who were also kept out of parts of the meeting. We were told that we would be told when to enter. And they would sit there and deliberate, you know, start to think at 2 or 3 o'clock, and then eventually they would call.
A secretary would come out, or
somebody would call us out.
That would have been Arthur O'Neill.
Arthur, old red-headed Arthur, that's right. I remember him. Somebody would call us in.
And that was Enor's way, or was it the whole of the committee's way?
Would all be like this, because I remember, and I was very much involved, and Bede Morris and myself really were involved in bringing faculty into action in the school, and one of the crucial meetings, in fact, I chaired.
A meeting of the permanent staff.
A meeting of the staff. To that, I understand that somebody told me that Enor said to them or to somebody else in their presence that Harry couldn't do this because, you know, Harry couldn't run a kindergarten. which, knowing him, you know, I took. It was almost an expected reaction from him. Anybody, you know, that had any differing opinion from him, either couldn't run a kindergarten or he had this permanent question. He says, "Where did you get the information from?" As if nobody was capable of getting the true gen except, you know, people in his status. But we got the faculty. But when we were on the faculty, all the heads of departments had something to say against it. And, I mean, the most ridiculous thing came from Ketchesite, who went up and said, "All right, we can have this increased meeting, but why should we call it a faculty? I suggest we call it a moot." You know, and everybody burst out laughing. You see, I mean, there were faculties in every school and department by then in the university, except in the John Curtin School. Or there may have been the School of Chemistry didn't have one, I can't remember now. And we just wanted the faculty, wanted the faculty board, and it was people bringing ridiculous objections. The table in the boardroom wasn't big enough to take the numbers, you know. So what? I mean, you got a workshop, make a bigger bloody table or something. Well, eventually, of course, we got a faculty, and it worked. But even so, I think they used to meet, you know, in an inner circle type of thing to discuss things. I don't know what the hell went on there.
Why was this the case? I mean, why was JCSMR so different from the other schools?
I don't know, because I think in the other schools there were maybe more enlightened professors or something like this that were prepared to do things otherwise. I really can't say.
Do you think the school committee did its job?
The school committee did mostly financial things. And I think they did the job in this respect. The school committee discussed the money distribution between departments, and they always came to agreement. I don't know how much fight, how much hard talking and fighting went on to distribute the money, but I think it was probably a very good gentleman's agreement in this respect. And I think that You know, they did their job, the technical job, well enough, but of course there may have been some sort of quiet executions that nobody heard about and the decision would be made. I mean, we had a fella, he was a professor of physiology, he eventually went McFarlane, now somehow he was chopped up. I don't know what happened, but McFarlane was shoved out of the place because he would criticize things, and he would criticize the order of things, and he was particularly heavy on Goddard and Jack White, because they were the instruments that through which he was subdued, you know. I mean, his orders in the workshop didn't get done, he complained that he wasn't getting, you know, a lot of money and things, and probably his complaint would be much more real than, say, the complaint that you get from, I'll name him, from Labour, right, who I think, from what I hear and know, his complaint about not getting funds is simply because he wouldn't go and ask for it or wouldn't go and sign a piece of paper, you know, and it is always so that when people transpose their complaints to another subject because they cannot put their complaint of the subject that really annoys them, because that's something entirely different. Mm. But I think McFarlane was somehow crucified, and I don't know how.
I haven't come across that either. What I have come across in the school committee records is that feeling that I mentioned to you off tape against the biological inorganic chemistry unit.
Against?
And specifically Albert. Against it.
Albert.
Specifically Albert's clearly stated opposition. Mm. He wanted his opposition to the unit recorded in the minutes. He didn't want the unit to grow. And somehow that was sustained after Dwyer's death. Not to the same extent.
Mm-hmm.
But there was either some sort of professional jealousy or antipathy there, which I can't get to the bottom of.
They did some very nice work, and of course, I mean, now, I mean, Ellen Sargeson, for instance, in the main school, I mean, he's a world authority. And the others that came afterwards, I think bringing back the good Australians in terms of that has succeeded in the school. I mean, you know, Craig, David Craig, and what's his name?
Birch.
Birch, yes, Arthur Birch. Well, Arthur Birch is, you know, a great world author. They were both very good chemists, and although they came in the latter part of their life, I think the years they gave to the school have done a lot for it. And now the School of Chemistry is a shining star in the crown of the university. And there's absolutely no doubt about it. It was a great thing to do. And Enor was very much involved in that. Very much involved in that. Now, how much of it was just his usual desire to bring good Australians and good people back, generally good people back to Canberra? I think that would have been his major reason for doing this. But the fact that there was a sort of a side product of this was diminishing Albert's light by putting a group of first-class chemists on the thing, well, I suppose he wouldn't have objected to that, putting it mildly.
Why didn't Albert like Dwyer?
I don't think that he didn't like Dwyer. I think maybe he may have been menaced by the fact that they are, you know, good chemists. And also because Dwyer had this biological thing about him, you see, and Albert, but he wasn't really in his department. I think he disliked him not so much personally, but the fact he disliked him like somebody dislikes a spike that's stuck in his bum or something like this. You see, I mean, Enor simply pushed the chemists a bit back and created those three or four rooms at the beginning of the corridor and said, Dwyer goes in there. Mm-hmm. So I suppose Enor looked at Dwyer as some bloody cuckoo bird, you know, in his nest. And that would be enough to resent the fella. He couldn't do anything.
Albert looked at him that way.
Albert would look at him that way. I'm sure they say Enor now. Mm-hmm. Albert would look at him that way. He was stuck in. And also, we were the best of friends with them, all of us. I mean, they were almost like part of us, really, instead of part of chemistry.
Is that because the nature of the chemistry unit that or the chemistry department that Albert set up was rather anomalous and didn't really fit in with the activities of the rest of the school?
I should imagine that in a way that would be true, yes. They were sort of encapsulated in working with the sort of things they liked. I think you should get that opinion from somebody else as well, because I think what I say now is sort of hearsay, and I could be wrong. But the impression I had, look, you should really talk to Will Famarego and to some of the other, there's somebody else, Gordon Barlin, still from the old days. There's nobody else is left. As I said, Des Brown probably won't talk. Mm. Des Brown would be the only guy that would know more about it than anybody else, and he probably won't talk. But I know definitely that work of biological nature was discouraged, even though the compounds they were all working on may have had considerable impact on biology and medicine.
So in a way, the biological Dwyer's unit had a closer relationship with the rest of the school than Albert's
right.
did.
And that may have been one of the reasons, but again, I don't know. There may have been personal things, there may have been professional things. It's something I can't say. Mm. I think your best bet on this would be Alan Sargeson. Mm. And I'm sure he'll talk. He may have to talk some parts of the record, but he might give you the picture. And he's a really good guy. If you catch him in the country, that is. Mm. Mm. Because he's so internationally, well known that he travels an awful lot. Mm. He's away a lot of time. So, but I suggest Alan Sargeson would be your best man. But if you look, and you know, there was Buckingham, and there were other, all the boys that came out of there, all the students and others are all of them now in either professorial or seminal positions. It was a good nucleus from which a lot of stuff grew.
Mm. In when we went through the list of heads of departments and their relationship with mm-hmm. him, or we missed out on Eccles.
Yeah, well, I think Eccles overshadowed everybody around the place. But I think from what I noticed, their relationship were cordial and probably friendly. Probably even friendly. I think, see, the things that happened in school committee, I don't know, but I think they were, I just heard some things about, but I don't know how true it is, but for instance, if Eccles wanted to put somebody in the academy or something like this, well, he got him into the academy, you know, and other people sometimes maybe try to show that they could also put somebody in the academy, and maybe they were or were not successful and these sort of things, you know. But obviously Eccles with his Nobel Prize has overshadowed people. And again, I think Eccles' departure had something to do with the fact that the university or the school, I can't say who, would not give him a setup to stay on. Have you heard any of that? You have to talk to David Curtis, probably.
I have to go into the records in greater detail, too. I've just sort of reached that stage. Certainly the school anticipated giving him space and
That's
so
right.
on.
Space, but either he wanted too much or they wouldn't give him enough. I don't know. You know, it's like saying that the glass is half full or half empty. Mm. It's the same thing. Mm. But I guess given sort of a facility that he would settle down with, he would have stayed in Canberra. Mm.